say we have a busy schedule is a little bit of an understatement. We're going to start off with House Bill 3375, and then we'll move to 3213. So we have a distinguished senator with us, and good morning, Ted. If you would like to speak, we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3375. Good morning, Senator.
If you don't mind, I'd like to have Mr. Schlack join me from Associated Directors.
Certainly.
Mr. Chairman, honored members of the committee, this gives me this morning an opportunity. Ted Varioli, State Senator, District 30, for the record. This morning gives me an opportunity to keep a promise I made in a previous legislative session, and that was that attending Senate Bill 12. Senate Bill 12 was an opportunity for Oregon to deal with a couple of very troubling issues. One was the issue of rapidly moving landslides, the attempt at a creation of transferable development rights, and the attempt, in fact, to protect our forest products industry from lawsuits arising from timber harvesting that was done under the office. At the time, Senate Bill 12 was being negotiated, it was very clear that we were entering uncharted waters, especially relative to the idea of creating an obligation for transferable development rights, mapping rapidly moving landslide hazard areas, essentially trying to prevent people from building their homes in harm's way when that was a clear and present danger, protecting liability for agencies or governmental units that were offering building permits against their better judgment in areas subject to rapidly moving landslides, and then protecting the upland timber landowners from potential liability relating to timber harvesting in those areas if a rapidly moving landslide should occur. Colleagues, you may be wondering what kind of a relating clause would carry all of those different and seemingly disparate issues. For history's sake, if you wish to, I urge you not to look back at Senate Bill 12. Senate Bill 12 was a failure. It didn't accomplish any of the objectives. It did require the making of some maps, which now has the landowners and counties and cities obligated to notify landowners about the potential for rapidly moving landslides. We never have been able to come up with a reasonable scheme for the transferability of development rights. And so at the time that Senate Bill 12 was passed, I made the promise to Mr. Schlack that I would help shepherd this process until I was certain that it was successful, and failing that, helping repeal the bill. That's why I'm here this morning. House Bill 3375 simply authorizes local governments to deny habitable structure building permits in areas that are clearly indicated as being in the path of potential hazard from rapidly moving landslides. And changes or repeals the mitigation thresholds, and essentially accepts the fact that the transferability of development rights is still untested in uncharted waters. There is some precedent for transferability of development rights in Oregon. That experiment is still unfolding. We're not certain that that ultimately will be successful in hindsight. So I'm here as a co-sponsor of House Bill 3375 in support of the passage of 3375, which I think Senate Bill 12 stands as a monument to fear and overreaching. And it's time we trimmed back this whole issue. House Bill 3375 accomplishes that.
Any questions in the Senate? Seeing none, thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to be heard and to keep a promise.
We'll hopefully keep your promise. Because we have another senator in our presence, Art, I'm going to ask you to take a back seat for a moment, and we're going to recess on House Bill 3375 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3213 and ask Senator Atkinson to come forward and
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jason Atkinson, State Senator from Southern Oregon. I foremost want to thank you for allowing me to speak quickly, and I also want to commend the Chair for working so closely with the Chair of the Senate Committee on Water and Land Use. It's nice to see the Chair here working bills so that we can get done on time and not be here in July. So thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
I come to you today in support of a bill, House Bill 3213, at the beginning of the process. It is an intent, I think it's an interesting bill, and I'm not here to speak to the bill. I'm actually here to speak with a friendly amendment, with which I believe has been furnished to the committee. It's the Dash 3 amendment to 3213. And what this has to do with is providing a little bit of flexibility with the conservation easement. When I started looking for ways to help on this particular project, there were several other bills that we looked at and the timelines that passed and whatnot, but we have offered this today as a completely friendly amendment to this bill. And what this does is it inserts language that says, notwithstanding the limitation on siting a destination resort within a 3 mile of a high value crop area, we provide some flexibility with regards to that 3 mile buffer zone between resort and high value farmland and actually putting that buffer area into a conservation easement. So that's what it does. With me today is Dave Riley, who I think can offer a little bit more insight as to exactly what we're trying to do here. But I appreciate the committee indulging me this morning, and with that I'll pass it off to Mr. Riley.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Garrard, distinguished members of the committee. I'm here, obviously, to support 3213 and the Dash 3 amendment. House Bill 3213 provides minor changes that will help rural Oregon counties participate in the economic development benefits which occur from the development of destination resorts while safeguarding resource lands simultaneously. House Bill 3213 provides for the following. First, it improves the phasing requirements. Second, it allows for assisted living facilities and nursing homes. Third, it as Senator Atkinson mentioned, it provides an incentive for the voluntary creation of a conservation easement, which serves to further protect the 3 mile buffer between a resort and a high value crop area by allowing those acres to be counted towards the 160-acre minimum acreage requirement. And finally, fourth, it allows counties to update their Goal 8 map through a post-acknowledgement plan amendment as opposed to the periodic review process. House Bill 3213 with the amendments in Dash 3 provides a unique opportunity to improve the destination resort statute without eroding the existing statutory conditions designed to protect resource lands. In the mid-1980s, the legislature determined that destination resorts are a viable economic development strategy. This bill improves the implementation of that strategy while preserving and enhancing the measures designed to minimize potential conflicts between resorts and high-value crop areas. House Bill 3213, as amended, is a win-win solution. And that concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions? Representative Gore?
No.
Oh, sorry.
I do, sir.
Representative Greenan.
All right. You could help me. What does 3213 precisely do? Are nursing home and other facilities allowed in destination resorts now?
Sure, our commissioners know that's not a listed allowable use in the current statute. This would be
so. This allows those to be sited inside a destination resort.
Correct.
Thank you, sir.
Any further questions? Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Very
thank
much.
You, the committee. Before you're caffeinated, I appreciate you getting me in. Thank you.
Thank you, baby. We have a sign-up. on 3213?
Maybe. That's a great idea.
That's not the only thing it does.
Yeah, that's what I'm afraid of. It's just those things that it kills.
Well, the rest of them, I can see, and then when I need the rest of them, I just convert over to the rest.
What else does it do?
I mean, I don't fully understand.
Linda Swearingen.
Yeah. I don't think so. I think it says the nursing home price can be afforded. I think the exit doesn't.
Yeah, that's.
Committee members, you do have a copy of the proposed amendment to 3213, which Mr. Kelly has just presented to us. Good morning, Linda.
Morning.
Nice to see a former county commissioner.
It's good to be here. It's actually better to be here out of office. Kristen?
Yeah, I'm going to go first and then turn the floor over to Linda and Tom Larson. My name is Kristen Udvari. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Ball Janik, and I'm here to testify in support of 3213 on behalf of Sun River and Eagle Crest Resorts. With me here today are Tom Larson, the managing director of Sun River, and Linda Swearingen, a legislative consultant with Eagle Crest. I will briefly explain the revisions to the destination resort statute proposed in HB 3213, and Ms. Swearingen and Mr. Larson will then provide testimony explaining why the resort community supports this bill. The bill proposes three separate amendments to the destination resort statute. I'll start with the simplest amendment, which addresses the issue of when a destination resort overlay map can be amended. The bill proposes to amend the final paragraph of ORS 197455, which should be on the final page of your bill, to allow local jurisdictions to revise their destination resort overlay maps at any time, so long as the revisions are processed consistent with the existing land use procedures governing comprehensive plan amendments and zoning map amendments. The current statute allows these maps to be amended only during periodic review. As you know, periodic review is a process by which LCDC reviews local comprehensive plans and land use regulations for consistency with state law. Periodic review is a multi-task and multi-year process that occurs infrequently, approximately every 10 to 15 years, for each jurisdiction. HB 3213 simply divorces destination resort maps from this process to allow the maps to be revised as necessary to reflect new information regarding potentially eligible or ineligible properties. The second amendment to the bill revises the overnight lodging standards. In its current form, the destination resort statute requires a resort to provide a minimum of 150 overnight lodging units and to maintain a 2-to-1 ratio between permanent residential units and overnight lodging units. Units qualifying as overnight lodging units include separately rentable hotel rooms, cabins, timeshare units, and individually owned dwellings if those dwellings are available for overnight rental by the general public through a central reservation and check-in service for a minimum of 45 weeks per calendar year. In other words, to be counted as an overnight lodging unit, a dwelling owner can use their vacation home for only 7 weeks per year and must relinquish control of all rental activities to the resort's central rental management office. As you will hear from Ms. Swearingen and Mr. Larson, Central Oregon resorts operating under these standards are consistently under-occupied, and the separately rentable units constructed under these rules have very high vacancy rates throughout most of the year. This inefficient and costly trend led to the introduction of the current bill, which maintains a 150-unit minimum and the 2-to-1 ratio, but expands the category of dwellings which can qualify as overnight lodging units to meet these standards. Under the proposed amendment, a resort must construct its first 50 overnight lodging units pursuant to the standards currently in place. The resort may then provide the remainder of the required 150 units and meet the 2-to-1 ratio by constructing individually owned dwellings that function as second homes rather than permanent homes. The dwellings can qualify as overnight lodging units if the owner is not registered to vote at the unit's resort address and does not receive the annual property tax assessment for the unit at the unit's resort address. This will allow resort owners to capture, for the purposes of meeting the minimum lodging standards, the many second homes within resorts that satisfy the recreational needs of both the owners and the renters. As noted in the written testimony submitted today, these homes are often rented by the individual owners rather than through the central resort service because the owners wish to retain the control of the rental activities and to expand personal use of their dwelling beyond the 7 weeks afforded by the statute. This amendment recognizes the recreational value of such units and enables resorts to construct the type of vacation homes truly in demand rather than overbuilding the hotel and timeshare units that are consistently under-occupied. The final amendment to the bill is simply a revision to the statute to clarify that assisted living facilities may be provided within a resort subject to compliance with the overnight lodging standards. Although not currently prohibited by the statute, local jurisdictions have been unsure whether such facilities are allowed within a resort. This amendment clarifies that they are permitted if the resort maintains compliance with the overnight lodging standards. I'll now turn it over to Linda and Tom for additional testimony.
I'm going to have to interrupt just for a moment and ask for indulgence, along with the committee's indulgence, because we have a representative here who would like to testify on the first bill we opened up. So everybody needs to grab a scorecard and keep track of everything. I'm going to recess the public hearing on 3375, reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3213, and welcome Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the professional courtesy. I have the higher education budget hearings going on in the room right behind you, and I think I have about $5,000 worth of, or $5,000 an hour worth of public employees sitting in there right now. For the record, my name is Susan Morgan. I'm state representative from House District 2, which is parts of Douglas County and Josephine and Jackson County. And I'm here today to give public testimony on House Bill 3375, and I just want to confirm that that was what you just opened.
And I think what I better do is correct my mistake very quickly. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3213, recess it, and then reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3375. Now you're okay to go, Susan.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3375 corrects a problem that Senator Ferrioli and I have been working on over the interim and that we also worked on in the last couple of sessions. Senate Bill 12 was a bill that we passed some time ago that dealt with landslide issues, and it is supposed to deal with landslides that provide a pronounced danger to humans and habitation and that can't be outrun. But part of the implementation of that bill was that the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries was charged with coming up with a set of maps that were supposed to show the high-risk areas for landslides. And that kicked in a time frame that gave the counties a certain amount of time to adopt within their local ordinances ways to deal with these high-risk areas. Well, when the maps came out of Dilgami, they covered huge areas of the state, and I think covered the issue that we got into with the agency was a discussion of risk, and I think that there was a grave difference in the amount of risk that Dilgami considered when they did their maps and what the legislative body was considering when we wrote Senate Bill 12. And so one of the things that we ran into was that by Dilgami issuing those maps that had huge areas of the state, for example, Douglas County, about half of the county was designated as high risk for these deadly landslides, that kicked in a clock that ticked that ended up in a building moratorium in jurisdictions that didn't have plans in place to deal with these landslide issues. And given the huge scope of land, there was very little probability that anybody was going to make it to the finish line before the moratorium kicked in. So Dilgami had their board, their governing board, pulled back the maps and relabeled them as study maps, which stopped the clock ticking on the moratorium. And we went to work to try to figure out a more long-term solution to the issue, and House Bill 3375, I think, is a way to look at that solution. I think that through our discussions, it became very evident that the best place to deal with the issue was in the local jurisdictions, and that you have people within the planning departments of the cities and the counties that have a good understanding of what the local areas look like and have a long, strong background in dealing with land use management issues in their own areas. And that probably what we wanted to do was to return the authority to the cities and the counties for managing the placement of residential dwellings, and I think that Senate Bill 3375 clearly does that. I think that this is a much more rational approach to trying to deal with high-risk geological areas that doesn't end up putting a lot of financial burden on applicants or on the cities or on the counties to comply with Senate Bill 12. And I just very shortly or very simply want to urge you to adopt the bill and send it on through the system, because I think that there are some fixes in here that are very much needed to deal rationally with the problem. And I would open to any questions that you may have.
Any questions of Representative Morgan? Seeing none, thank you, Susan.
Thank you very much.
We'll let you get back to your committee. Okay, well, now we can stay with 3375 and finish it, and I think perhaps that committee, you have any feelings on which way you want to go? Keep bouncing back and forth or finish one here?
You have the votes.
Let's go ahead and we'll finish 3375. We have five people to testify, and they're all in favor of the bill. So since we apparently have no opposition to 3375, I'd ask Linda Ludwig, Vicki McConnell, and Phil Steinbeck to come forward, please, and ask you again to keep your testimony as brief as possible. And we'll actually try and get some piece of paper off this desk in front of us. Good morning. Linda?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. As you already heard very eloquent testimony from Representative Morgan, Senator Ferrioli, and I believe from our Schlag of Association of Oregon Counties, I've supplied you with some written testimony in favor and support of this bill, and ask that you would move this bill along today.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Phil Stenbeck with the Douglas County Planning Department. There's a handout there you should be getting any minute now. The planning department basically has 5 points that we would like to have you consider. In looking at the language of HB 3375, there is a request in that bill to amend land use regulations or adopt new ones. We have no objection to that. We support the repeal of ORS 195-263. That particular component of the Oregon Revised Statutes kind of forced an approval of a dwelling in a hazardous area. The repeal of it will give local government the opportunity to protect citizens, protect their health, safety, and welfare. The opportunity to deny a dwelling is very rare due to the fact that a rapidly moving landslide likely will not encompass an entire property. The third comment has to do with the TDR program. Over the years, since 1996, the Douglas County Planning Department has been involved with studying land use regulations pertaining to rapidly moving landslides, which included a study of the TDR programs. We feel that the TDR program for rapidly moving landslides would not be successful, and we support the repeal of ORS 195-266 and ORS 195-270. Our fourth comment has to do with ORS 195-275, which has to do with the time frame, the moratorium time frame, that appears to have had a significantly adverse effect to implementation of the regulations, and we support repeal of that. There's also language pertaining to forest practices rules, which appears to be a clarification, and we have no objection to that. So all in all, we support HB 3375 and urge you to support it also.
Thank you. We'll save the questions for the panel when they've all completed. Good morning.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Vicki McConnell, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. I am here also to testify in support of the House Bill 3375. I handed out a quick handout there for you as well, and we just have a couple of points to make on this. The first point being that This bill had a very broad scope, attempting to deal with description and mandating the task of identifying a certain geologic hazard. As you may have recognized from the previous testimony, GOGAMI was tasked with producing these rapidly moving landslide hazard maps. And it's very difficult to set your policy for land use decisions before you know the character and the scope of the geologic hazard. And I think I suggest that that's part of what has kind of brought some of the misunderstandings here and what this bill, House Bill 3375, will work on fixing. What we have done is released a set of maps that we, it's in our interpretive map series, IMS 22, which offers an overview, an overview mapping of this type of hazard, of an areas that could be part of a potential for a rapidly moving landslide. And what we are doing now is working with the cities and counties, and with forestry to bring in the next iteration of these maps, which would look at a relative hazard instead of simply where you may have a hazard or where you would not have a hazard. That's our next set of maps. We on your list, we're actually going to release some relative hazard maps on an interactive website, and we'll be able to then get feedback from the cities and counties. And we are looking at some funding with LCDC and possibly with Douglas County on a pilot project or a pilot study for identifying the further review areas, which would be your sites of high risk for rapidly moving landslides. So we're very hopeful that this work can go on and we can have a good identification of this hazard, and that this bill, the amendment bill, will help in the policy decisions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee?
As usual.
Representative Greenlee.
You could help me a little bit. This is pretty arcane. It comes pretty fast. Can you tell me in simple language what the effect of deleting 195-263 is in terms of allowing a homeowner to build a home in a bad place or not allowing a homeowner to build a home in a bad place?
There's
too many negatives in that question, but
okay.
263 is to prevent, I assume, the siting of a home in a place that has a high landslide. Is repealing it make it easier to do that or harder to do that?
There was criteria that were used to examine a location, and if you met those criteria, when you got to a certain tier, you had certain choices to make. But there was actually a point where if you went all the way through the process, you could do things, you could still build in that same location, even though you knew it was a dangerous location. And we had no opportunity for denial. Local governments feel when they have we have an obligation to citizens having to do with health, safety, and welfare. And we feel that when you have to choose between compensation or loss of life, we want the ability to choose compensation. We feel an obligation to people in our community to do that. That makes sense.
Thanks, Lewis. Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, thank you, panel.
Thank you.
And I'll bring up the next panel. And Art, I apologize to you this morning because I skipped you when I was going back over. But Art Schlack, Ray Wilkerson, and Keith Mills. This will conclude our testimony on this bill.
Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, I'll start at this point. For the record, my name is Art Schlack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm pleased to be here, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in support of House Bill 3375. I have a written statement that is being distributed to you, as well as a statement from Josephine County Planning Department in support of House Bill 3375. I believe that Senator Ferrioli and Representative Morgan have kind of laid out the issues. Senate Bill 12 from the 99 session was extremely broad, as spoken to, and it tried to do three things. It called for mapping of potential landslide areas. It tried to set a level playing field between upland landowners and landowners in the lower areas. And then third thing it tried to do was establish some land use regulations that limited local government's ability to manage the placement of dwellings. And in doing that, it did it prior to having any idea as to where these landslide areas might be. House Bill 3375 returns the management of the placement of dwellings to local government, and we urge your support, as you've heard from the previous speakers, for this bill, and to move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you, Art. Good morning.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm Ray Wilkinson with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. We represent private forest landowners. Just real quickly, by way of background, our involvement with this issue began in the fall of 1996 when there was two or three very tragic and fatal landslides that occurred in Douglas County. And those landslides, the origination site, was in places where timber harvesting had occurred recently. And that caused, obviously, a lot of notice and concern, and what was quickly became apparent was two things. One is the Board of Forestry did not have authority to regulate logging for the purpose of protecting public safety. That was not an option for under the Forest Practices Act. The second thing that became apparent, thanks to a very exhaustive study that the Department of Forestry did, was that there is some, it's not a lot, there is some correlation between landslides and logging. Basically, for a brief period of time after a logging operation, the risk of landslide increases to some degree. So because of those two things, we agreed to support legislation that basically gave the state authority to restrict our operations if there was a discernible risk of a landslide that could kill or injure people. We were very much involved with Senate Bill 12 two sessions ago, and the specific piece of this bill that's before you today that's of direct interest to us is on page 2, lines 8 through 11. The previous panel referenced that. What the intent of Senate Bill 12 was that timber harvest could be restricted to protect human life on the dwellings that exist at the time the bill was passed, but in terms of future construction, those restrictions should not apply. And the language of Senate Bill 12 on that point was not as clear as it should have been or could have been, and this bill clarifies that to make that absolutely clear, and that's the reason for our direct interest and support for House Bill 3375. Beyond that, however, this whole, since 1996, the solution to this problem has been built on what's called shared responsibility. We're willing to allow the state to restrict our activities, but public safety also ought to have some, there ought to be some basis to restrict construction of buildings in places that are clearly dangerous. There's not very many of these sites. You know, you have to have a unique combination of circumstances in order to have this situation occur. And so it's not overly burdensome on us on those sites to have those restrictions, and shouldn't be on the general public either. But we support the broad concept and the public policy here in addition to the specific section that affects us directly. So urge your support and appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Keith Mills. I'm the staff geotechnical engineer in the Oregon Department of Forestry. I've been involved with the landslides issue for about 20 years, and in 1996 with the public safety issue, provided technical support to the task force on landslides and public safety, just recently worked with the Board of Forestry to adopt the regulations that Ray referred to on forest practices and landslides and public safety. These changes that change the provisions that were originally in Senate Bill 12, we've worked with local governments on their concerns with these. They these changes will help local governments better implement the rules and have a shared responsibility without lowering public safety protection and without increasing cost to local governments. So for all these reasons and for all the things that have been stated before that I don't need to repeat that the other speakers have talked about, the Department of Forestry supports House Bill 3375, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify.
Does the committee have any questions of our panel? Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The committee would probably be well to take note and make a mark on their calendar that today we had a bill that there was no opposition to in this committee. I think this is a milestone of some kind.
Too good to be true.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh. Representative.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, it is April Fool's Day.
Oh, yes. Okay. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3375 and open a work session on House Bill 3375, and the chair would seek a motion. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 3375 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves House Bill 3375 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll. Representative Zahner is excused. Representative Gerard votes aye. So House Bill 3375 is passed, and we will have Representative Morgan, because this is her district, carry the bill. So thank the committee. And now we'll go back to House Bill 3213 and open the public hearing on House Bill 3213 and re-invite our guests, who I appreciate their indulgence.
Representative Gerard and committee members, my name is Linda Swearingen. I represent Eagle Crest Resort in Redmond and the Running Y Ranch in Klamath Falls, and I urge your support of HB 3213. I've had the pleasure of serving the City of Sisters as a planning commissioner and the mayor, the City of Redmond as the executive director of the Redmond Chamber of Commerce, and most recently the chair of the Deschutes County Commission. During my tenure as an appointed and elected official, I had the opportunity to closely work with three local destination resorts, Black Butte Ranch, Eagle Crest Resort, and Sun River. Destination resorts in Deschutes County play a very big role in shaping our community and economy. The market value of the three destination resorts in Deschutes County is $2 billion. This amount exceeds the value of all commercial and industrial land in the county. Destination resorts represent 15% of our market value in Deschutes County. They contribute more than $13.5 million in property tax revenue and are some of our region's largest employers. Eagle Crest Resort alone employs over 550 local citizens. Black Butte Ranch accounts for approximately 60% of our sister school district tax base, while it only accounts for 2.5% of all students within the district. Destination resorts are a unique industry because they are responsible for providing their own infrastructure and are exempt from receiving any public subsidy for locating in a community. They don't ask for tax credits, enterprise zone status, or tax subsidies. They come into your community and fit a market niche that other tourist attractions are unable to address. Destination resort property owners generally use their property as second home or vacation rental properties and demand very little in the way of public services. HB 3213 would allow destination resort developers the opportunity to plat additional residential lots as opposed to overnight lodging units. And I'd like to just say
right here. This does not change the cap that the county has imposed on them. For example, at Eagle Crest, they have approval for 2,550 units, and this bill would not change that. It would just change the mix of residential lots versus overnight lodging units. If, in fact, they wanted to change the total amount of lots, they'd have to go through the local public process as well. Gives them an opportunity to build assisted living facilities, an option to work with local officials to amend or revise the county's destination resort map outside of periodic review. Jerry Anders could not be here today. He is the CEO of Eagle Crest Resort and is also involved with the Running Y Ranch in Klamath Falls. And they've been working with the legislature to address this problem since 1993. In fact, in 1993, Representative Clarno introduced House Bill 2932 to amend the destination resort statute to reduce the overnight lodging requirements from 150 to 75 units and change the permanent residential unit overnight lodging unit ratio from 2 to 1 to 5 to 1. The 45-week standard was also debated during hearings on the bill. The original text of this bill was ultimately amended to replace the proposed reduction in overnight lodging units with a provision allowing the first phase of the resort to contain only 75 units. However, the ultimate 150-unit requirement was retained, as was the 2-to-1 ratio. After 10 years, it has become apparent that this compromise did not adequately address resort owners' and developers' concerns. Under these overnight lodging restrictions, resorts such as Eagle Crest and Running Y Ranch have repeatedly posted low occupancy rates for the mandated overnight lodging units. For example, the occupancy rate for the inn at Eagle Crest was 37%. Excluding company-generated marketing guests in 2001 and 2002. Even worse, the occupancy rate at the Running Y Hotel, excluding company-generated marketing guests, was 13.4% in 2001 and 17.8% in 2002. To maintain viability, especially during troubled economic times such as the present, it is imperative that resorts have the flexibility to provide the type of units that truly attract resort visitors and to encourage individual investment in those units. And we believe the bill offered, the amendment offered to this particular state statute would address those concerns. And I would also like to say that while we've had an opportunity to look at the Dash 3 amendment, we are opposed to it. We do not believe that it should be included in this bill. It needs to stand on it. On its own, it is certainly an amendment that is a lot more controversial than what we are proposing here today.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and distinguished members of the committee. I'm Tom Larson. I'm a part owner in Sun River Resort, and I'm the managing director of the company. Linda and Kristen have already explained what our goal in this new House bill is that Sun River, which has been a long-standing, one of the oldest and most reputable resorts, I hope that you will agree with in the state. It's our position that destination resorts and tourism drives the economy of Central Oregon. As a result, we support House Bill 3213. I've also submitted to you, for the written record, the letter that's in front of you. I'd like to read a few excerpts from that. Sun River was established in Deschutes County in approximately 1968, prior to the adoption of Oregon's current land use laws and the Destination Resort Statute. As a result, the resort operates as an unincorporated community, or a UUC, rather than a Goal 8 destination resort. However, any expansion of Sun River to meet the high demand for recreational resort facilities in Central Oregon will be governed by Goal 8 and the Destination Resort Statute. Because of the overnight lodging standards, the statute has inhibited the expansion of one of Oregon's oldest and most popular destination resorts, Sun River. The amendments proposed in House Bill 3213 will enable Sun River to provide further opportunities for recreational lodging in close proximity to all Central Oregon's tourist amenities, including Mount Bachelor. The current destination resort statute requires a resort to provide a minimum of 150 overnight lodging units and to maintain a 2-to-1 ratio between permanent residential units and overnight lodging units. If a resort wishes to rely upon individually owned units to meet the 150-unit minimum and the 2-to-1 ratio, the statute requires those units to be available for overnight rental by the general public through a central reservation and check-in service for at least 45 weeks per the calendar year. This allows the dwelling owners only 7 weeks of personal use within that year. Market research reveals that Oregon resorts operating under these standards are consistently underoccupied as you heard from Jerry Andrews from Eagle Crest. And the separately rentable units constructed on the rules have very high vacancy rates throughout most of the year. Sun River has found that most vacationers in Central Oregon prefer to rent single-family dwellings. Clearly, that's a byproduct of what is a family destination attraction of Central Oregon and all the amenity offerings. However, it's not economical for resorts to construct and own these dwellings as well as rental units. Rather, it's most efficient for such dwellings to be individually owned and available for vacation use for both the owners and the public. Given the likelihood of high vacancy rates within separately rentable resort-owned units, Sun River is reluctant to invest in expanded resort facilities if that expansion requires the construction of 150 unneeded hotel units. In addition, given the lack of interest by potential second home buyers in purchasing homes for personal use, it is restricted to 7 weeks per year, and they cannot control the rental of the units. Sun River is not confident that they can meet the 150-unit minimum and a 2-to-1 ratio through the use of individually owned units under the current scheme. Therefore, Sun River urges the committee to adopt House Bill 3213, thereby creating a third option for resorts to meet the overnight lodging standards. The amended statute will continue to encourage recreation consistent with Goal 8 and will simply alter the percentage of weekend visitors versus repeat second home visitors. However, the ratio between permanent homes and second homes will remain intact. In the closing of my written summary, you'll see just how I state the benefits of the destination resorts, and clearly that's part of the economy, especially in Central Oregon, whether that's be it employment, tax valuation for the property, et cetera. I think all those are fairly clear to you. So Sun River, along with Jerry Andrews of Eagle Crest, appreciate your support of House Bill 3213. Thank you.
Any questions of our panel? Seeing none, thank you.
Thanks.
Let's see. Carrie McLaren?
Good morning, Chair Garrard, members of the committee. My name is Carrie McLaren. I'm the staff attorney for 1000 Friends of Oregon, and I'm speaking today in opposition to House Bill 3213, as well as the proposed Dash 3 amendments. The purpose of Goal 8 and the Destination Resort Siting Statutes is, as people have spoken to, is really to expand or diversify the state's economy. And the way in which destination resorts do that is by attracting visitors who stay over the long term rather than just overnight guests. If you look back at some of the legislative history that led to the statutes in Chapter 197, a critical element was, one, to balance the preservation of agricultural and farmland for farm and timber use with destination resorts, remembering that these destination resort siting statutes allow farm and forest land to be used for destination resorts. We're not talking about rural residential land or other land zoned for other uses here. And secondly, that it was really to promote resort development, not to lead to rural residential subdivisions. And so we need to keep those intents, I think, in mind in reviewing these amendments to the statutory scheme in House Bill 3213. The three changes that are fundamental in House Bill 3213 is, one, to change the definition of overnight lodging units. I would suggest that if you read the amendments at the top of page 2 together with the revisions in subsection 4, what it leads to essentially is that only 50 units of overnight lodging accommodations and how we would probably typically think of that in terms of lodge-like setting are required. I would also note as you're reviewing this that there's nothing that prohibits current destination resorts from building single-family dwellings to use as overnight accommodations and renting them themselves, and wonder how it is economically feasible for an individual to own and rent that house out, and it's not economically feasible for the resort to. If Sun River and other destination resorts find that single-family dwellings are what is more attractive for their customers, there's nothing that prohibits them from building those single-family homes, making those available through their central reservation system and meeting the current ratio required by law. There are some substantial probably enforcement issues in terms of whether or not these homes that are originally built under subsection paragraph little B on the top of page 2, how we really ensure that these dwellings do not become converted to rural residences and then command quite a good deal of community services. With respect to the nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and residential facilities for long-term care, I suggest that runs directly counter to the original purpose of Goal 8 and of the Destination Resort Siting Statutes, and is not in keeping with the attraction of visitors to add to the to add value into that local economy by attracting visitors from other places in Oregon or from outside the state, which is the purpose of these provisions. With respect to the Dash 3 amendments, those fundamentally alter what has been known as the buffer zone between high-value crop areas, our best of the best agricultural land, and the destination resorts. That buffer is designed to create a distance between the conflicts that arise between resort and residential development and farm use. And we strongly oppose those revisions and would urge the committee not to include the Dash 3 amendments as part of this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have or provide further information for you at another time if that's helpful.
Any questions?
Yeah.
Representative Greenlee.
Please talk to me a bit more about the Dash 3 amendments. I mean, are you saying that if the bill passes, you would rather see the bill pass without the Dash 3 amendments or with the Dash 3 amendments? And why is a conservation zone, a confirmation easement doesn't serve as a buffer?
I'm going to take a Chair Garrard, Representative Green, like a first stab since I haven't had much time to review these amendments. With respect to your first question, I would not like to see the bill pass in either form. I think it really does substantial damage to agricultural and farmland protection. So that's a choice I can't make. I would highlight that they are dealing with two different subject matters, and that's, I guess, what I would offer for the two different subjects within the destination resort statutes. What essentially, under ORS Chapter 197, a destination resort is required to be sited on at least a 160-acre site, and that whole site must be 3 miles out, 3 miles away from a high-value crop area. What this does is allow that destination resort site to float in to the 3 mile buffer area. It is not clear from these amendments that it would prohibit resort activities. I would imagine that it would probably prohibit residential development or lodge development on that site, but maybe not. These amendments certainly don't make that clear. To the extent that they prohibit that kind of development, I don't believe that they would prohibit using that land as a golf course, which is a permitted, which can be permitted sometimes in a farm or forest area. It doesn't prohibit using it for Nordic skiing. Doesn't prohibit hiking trails, biking trails. Essentially, resort development of the area in that conservation easement. And so, I think what this does in essence is reduce the 3 mile buffer.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
And our
the amendments up here in case anybody else needs.
Our final testimony on this bill is from Bob Rindy. Morning, Bob.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And I do have to apologize at the outset that Destination Resorts is a subject that is fairly complex, and the person in our office who deals with these is on vacation. But I will do my best to try to give you our analysis of the bill. We're concerned about the bill mainly in that we do think the most important matter that brought this bill about was a negotiation that happened when that statute was initially adopted in terms of making sure that a destination resort is really a destination resort and is not in some manner a rural residential subdivision for permanent homes or some other use. And I think the statute did a good job of that in the provisions that are in there. And one of the main provisions to make sure that occurs is the ratio of rentable units to permanent units, including the initial requirement for 150 rentable units. What this bill does is change that. And I heard the testimony of those who think that that provision doesn't work very well today, and I this is the first we'd heard that, but I think that is important testimony, and I don't have a way to evaluate that, but to the extent that these resorts that we have now have a high vacancy rate, I think indeed that may indicate that there's problems with this. What I want to make sure that we understand is that as proposed, This bill will require 50, understanding is 50 rentable units initially, and from then on, any number of permanent homes could be built. So you might get something out there that initially begins as a destination resort, or which is called a destination resort, but that over time, or even as part of its initial application, would be predominantly for rental of permanent homes, second homes, that were not part of a rental pool. And I also concur with the previous speaker about the assisted living units. I don't understand why that would be proposed here. Typically, those kind of facilities need to be close to health care facilities and other things that you don't typically have in remote rural areas where many of these resorts will be developed. The language that has them in there is ambiguous, and it's certainly conceivable that it could be interpreted to mean that those are also rentable units. So this also erodes the provisions we have on the ratio of those units. Our LCDC has the authority to write rules on resorts and has adopted Goal 8 with some provisions that parallel the statute. I think there are a number of ways to resolve the issues here. This is one way. There are probably a dozen other ways that we could resolve problems with that ratio, especially if the problem is the seven weeks per year that the owner could live there. That's an example of something that we could amend and change to deal with it. And I'm not really qualified to propose to you other ways to do it. I just am certain there are a dozen other ways to resolve those issues. So I wanted to pose to you the fact that another way to resolve this is to open up those provisions and then through a longer process take testimony and try to decide the right ratio. I think it's important that a ratio be maintained, not necessarily the one that's there. And I think it's important that you have provisions in that statute that make sure that the initial units are predominantly, or a large proportion of those are rentable units, not necessarily the numbers that are currently in the statute. So I would urge you at least to consider a work group to try and see if we can, as we did in the initial phase of this, in the 93 session, I believe, see if we can find concurrence among the various parties to feel comfortable that we are indeed going to be building destination resorts rather than residential subdivisions in these rural areas. With that, I'll conclude, and I'll be happy to take questions.
Mr. Rendy, I have to tell you, I get real annoyed when I hear LCDC making a statement about where nursing homes and assisted living homes can be located. I think if a senior citizen wants to live in a resort area and have their second home, first home, whatever there, I think they have that right. And I don't think LCDC should be dictating that they can live there or not because of proximity to health services. That's my own personal opinion. But I think that's part of what's wrong in this state right now, is that you folks are involved in way too many decisions that you really shouldn't be.
Mr. Chair, in response, I need to be clear that our concern, we want to point out the concern that it is, as a land use practice, and I'm a land use planner, that it would generally make good sense to make sure that those facilities are located near health care. But our concern with the provisions is not them in themselves. It is that the wording is ambiguous as to whether they would count as rental units or not. And I think that can be repaired through the wording, but I did want to point out to you that it's not clear, with the way the bill is written now, whether those are unrentable or are rentable units. And it's crucial that you know that so that you can continue to meet the ratio.
Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Endy? Thank you, Bob. Dave Riley, would you come back up, please? This is, committee, this is in regards to the Dash 3 amendment.
Yes, sir.
Dave, is the Dash 3 amendment aimed at any particular resort area?
Currently, there's a resort in Hood River County that this could assist, and I want to address directly the point that Thousand Friends made, that this would be eroding the three-mile buffer by allowing a resort to float into it. I don't agree with that because of the definition of a conservation easement, which this Dash 3 amendment refers to ORS 271.715 through dot 795, which defines what a conservation easement is, and it does not allow for golf courses. Essentially, there are restricted uses that are more restrictive than what, for instance, Gulf War forest land would allow for naturally in that buffer area. So it's tightening up the restrictions within the buffer. And without this amendment, that buffer area would still be available for instance, conditional uses under Goal 4 or even Goal 2 exception. So if a resort were to voluntarily create this conservation easement, it would permanently protect that, that buffer area more effectively than without this amendment.
Any questions, Mr. Riley?
Yeah, I assume that's the resort in the Mount Hood National Forest on the east slopes of Mount Hood you're talking about?
Yes, that's correct. Chair Garrard, Commissioners, yes.
And this,
may I follow?
This would allow, essentially my understanding of this is this would allow a small, it would allow the portion of the land more than 3 miles from the district to be less than 160 acres. Because part of that 160 could be sited inside this conservation zone. Is that right? So, I mean, you might have 100 acres inside the conservation zone, and then you would have only 60 acres 3 miles from the high production farmland.
Chair Garrard, Commissioners, yes, that is correct. So the development of the resort still could not occur within the 3 mile buffer. And if a developer were to allocate part of those acres to this conservation easement within the buffer area, then yes, the remainder, which is outside of the 3 mile buffer, would get smaller. So it's smart growth. It would force the developer to have a more compact development on a smaller footprint and put a conservation easement in place in the area that is intended to be protected to avoid the potential conflicts between a resort and high-value farmland. That's why I was saying earlier, I really believe this is a win-win amendment.
Yeah, and I'll follow very briefly one more.
Follow.
So that, I'm essentially, if you can't site 160 acres 3 miles from this land as the bill intends, this would allow you to site a much smaller resort 3 miles away. I mean, it could be 25 or 50 acres. I mean, it means if you don't have a site that's 160 acres, all 3 mile, you could cite, essentially you could violate the spirit of the law quite a lot by having a very small resort 3 miles from the...
Chair Garrard, Commissioners, except for the other provisions in Goal 8 ORS 197 that require other things to occur that would not prevent, or that would not allow for that to happen. For example, the existing statute requires that the developer invests a minimum of approximately $2.1 million in developed recreation facilities. You can't do that on a tiny piece of ground. You also have to continue to maintain a open space requirement of 50% of the site. So in your example, if it were 5 acres left and 155 in a conservation easement inside of the 3-mile buffer, it's essentially impossible to do. So you still have to have a critical mass of acreage to meet the other requirements in Goal 8, even with these changes. So it will be a legitimate destination resort in that respect, which is I think what you're getting at is some little tiny resort located out there, or maybe multiple little resorts out there. It's really, if you look at this in the context of the other requirements, it's really impossible to do that.
Thank you, sir.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Don Schellenberg. Don wanted to comment on the -3 amendment, so that's what we're really taking a serious look at this point. Don, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. Just having the time to look at these. The 160-acre issue, that's a minimum, not a maximum. So the way this amendment is written, the conservation easement can be within 3 miles of high-value cropland, and they could still have a 200-acre destination resort over and above whatever land they have in a conservation easement. So I think I don't want the committee to be fooled by the fact that this would be within 3 miles. The purpose of the 3-mile buffer is for high-value cropland. Well, what happens on high-value cropland? There's a lot of activity that goes on high-value cropland that is not conducive to people who are recreating. It may be smell, it may be dust, it may be drift of irrigation, it may be there's chemical application, all kinds of things. That's the reason for the 3 miles, and we would be opposed to the -3 simply on that basis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Any questions? So Representative Doyle.
I guess I'm curious, though, if maybe you can explain more. If you've got the 3-mile buffer, I mean, this doesn't change the 3-mile buffer. So all it does is allow then, you know, if there is a conservation easement, which many times there is not. I mean, and the easement does not have to be abutted to the buffer. So all you're doing is just allowing, you know, the owners to put a portion of their land as conservation easement and have it included in the 3-mile zone. So, you know, you're not getting anything differently, are you?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Law, I'm not sure on the conservation easement that those limitations are quite as tight as what was being said. There are a lot of different kinds of conservation easements. A conservation easement is simply an agreement between two parties for whatever kind of restrictions they want to put on the land. I would need to know more about what can or can't be done on that conservation easement before I would consider that to be a part of the 3-mile limitation. Because I think there are activities that could occur on that conservation easement that would not be conducive to the adjoining agricultural property.
Yes. Any further questions, Representative Greenland?
Yeah, I'm particularly concerned with the site that's the reason for this amendment. That proposed resort turns out to be very close to some very high-value pear orchards and other kinds of things. And my impression is that the original intent, and I'd like you to comment on this, on the 160 acres, was to have an area that wasn't highly concentrated, that the purpose of having a minimum of 160 was that it left a lot of open room. And what I wonder if the purpose of this amendment wouldn't allow a much more compact and intense use within 3 miles of that farm, of those orchards in Hood River County, than might be available if the site was to be the full 160 acres that far away. I wonder if that's the...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlake, that would depend on the size of the total site. I mean, again, they could have purchased, and I have no idea what it is, but maybe they've got 500 acres, and maybe they only put 100 acres in conservation easement. They'd still have 400 acres to accomplish that purpose. Again, I think the purpose of the 160 acres, one of the purposes was to distinguish between a destination resort and the guest ranch issue. Two different types of entities. And then also, well, I'll stop there.
Yeah, if I can follow up. I mean, if they have 400 acres, that's more than 3 miles away. There's no need for this amendment. They can have a conservation easement or not have a conservation easement. If they have 400 acres and it's all 3 miles away, they can site their resort on that 400 acres. This amendment isn't relevant. It's only if they don't have 160 acres 3 miles away that this amendment is relevant, which automatically makes for a more concentrated development.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlight, thank you. I understand what your point is now. Thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Doug.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
This is what I'll refer to as an unfriendly amendment,
yeah,
and that it is not coming from the folks who sponsor this bill, and it does, in my opinion, change the intent of the bill.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, the chair will not recognize the -3 amendment. So we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3375, and I'm sorry, 3213. My roadmap gets more and more messed up here, folks. We'll close the public hearing on 3213 and open a work session on House Bill 3213. Chair looks for motion.
Mr. Chair, I move the original House Bill 3213 be moved out of committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Richardson moves House Bill 3213 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Rosenbaum.
No.
Representative Greenlight.
No.
Representative Doyle.
Aye.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Donner.
Aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Mr. Chair.
Gerard.
Aye.
I'd like to change my vote. Before the gavel goes down. Okay. I'd like to change the vote to aye.
Representative Greenlight.
Representative Greenlight.
Changes his vote to aye. House Bill 3213 is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Representative Westland will carry the bill. And let's see. We have a lot of housework to do. We wanted a... Representative Zoner, want to make a motion to allow him to vote on 3375? Okay, we need a motion from a member to allow Representative Zoner to vote on House Bill 3375. To suspend the rules.
I move we suspend the rules and allow Representative Zoner, whatever his name is, to vote on...
what's his name?
On 3375.
Representative Greenlick has moved that we suspend the rules to allow
somebody.
Representative Donner to vote on House Bill 3375. Seeing no objection, it's approved. Representative Donner, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Donner votes aye. So recorded. So closed. Let's see. We have a lot of what we call tap-taps coming up. So I'm almost hesitant, but let's start in on another bill here. These things always take so much longer than you anticipate, and we'll save the tap-taps for right toward the end, around 10:30. So we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2820, and we'll see who's here.
Other than agency people.
Committee, we have 6 people who have signed up to speak on this bill, so we'll try and finish this by 10:15 approximately so that we can do our housekeeping that we need to do before we get out of here. Ross Day, Don Schellenberg, and Art Schlott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for your record, Ross Day, Fort Wilmington in Action. For you, you have House Bill 2820, which requires LCDC, state agencies, and local government, when applying a land use regulation, legislative land use regulation, to do an economic impact analysis on individual properties that the proposed change is going to affect. Now, you've heard for 3 months testimony from individuals whose property has been affected negatively, primarily, although Mitch Rose from the American Planner Association claims that land use regulations positively impacted his the value of his property as well, which is fine. But at no time for any of those properties was an economic impact analysis completed on the effect that the land use regulations would have on those individual properties. None of those circumstances did the commission or local government study to what extent the rule, the regulation, the land use restriction would have on the individual property. You're going to hear a lot of, I'm sure, a lot of warnings, more so than opposition to the bill, that this measure is going to cost too much, that it's going to gut land use regulation, it's going to make it impossible to implement land use regulations and restrictions. Those are, you know, complete dogs and cats living together, complete anarchy. Those are the same arguments they made in opposition to Measure 56, which is the measure which requires notice to landowners when a local government is proposing to take action which is going to affect their property. You're also going to hear that this is going to cost too much. Understand what that implies, if not explicitly states, and that is, it's not happening now. In essence, these land use regulations are being enacted without any regard for what it's going to cost Chair Girard in terms of the value of his property, either positively or negatively. These restrictions are being imposed blind without any regard for the economic impact they're having on property owners. So you have two choices here. We can continue on the path we're going, oblivious to what the effects of these regulations are really having on property owners, or what we can do is we can try to garner a little bit more information and find out what it is we're really doing. And think about it. We go through analyses which require resource analysis, transportation analysis, pollution analysis, God knows what else, but we don't do economic analysis. You might hear an argument saying, well, in Goal 5 and the EC process, we take into account general economic effect, and to a certain extent that's correct, but we don't go in and say, how is this particular regulation going to affect these 10 properties in this area? We don't do that, as opposed to what we do currently when we say, well, how is this rezone going to affect transportation? What impact is it going to have on transportation? And in fact, for instance, for many people in urban areas, what we end up doing is we end up assessing traffic impact fees as a result of those traffic analyses. Now, except for the moment, the state's assertion back during the Measure 7 debate that land use rate, that paying for Measure 7 was going to cost $5.8 billion. What that represents is $5.8 billion in lost value for property owners as a result of land use restrictions. In the event, and this is the argument that we will make until we're blue in the face, that is value that is lost to tax bases for local governments. What's happening now is we're enacting land use restrictions and we're not taking into account the economic impact. Local governments don't know how much they're restricting their own property tax base. So it just makes no sense. You might hear an argument, too, that this might constitute an unfunded mandate under Article 11, Section 15 of the Oregon Constitution. Well, there's a subsection, a specific exemption in the unfunded mandate sections of the Constitution, which says that statutes enacted, programs enacted, if you will, by this body that are designed to basically give the public more information or exempt from unfunded mandate prohibition. You're probably going to hear claims, like I said earlier, that this bill will make it impossible to pass restrictions on property owners, make it impossible to effectively land use plan. Like I said, the argument that were made in opposition to Measure 56. In fact, opponents even argued that God didn't want property owners to be notified. There are arguments from various religious organizations saying that Measure 56 was a bad idea. I mean, that's the kind of chicken little sky is falling arguments we heard, and I suppose those are probably the same warnings that you're going to hear today. You may also hear that this is impossible to implement, and once again, those are the same arguments they made since Measure 56. What's happening with Measure 56? Landowners are being provided notice when a land use restriction is proposed that's going to affect their property. They're being encouraged, and in fact it's helping, with public involvement, which is a good thing. Last time I checked, public involvement is a good thing in our process. And as a result, it's actually opening up the process quite a bit. It's opening up the process to proponents and opponents of land use actions proposed by the government, by local governments. That's not necessarily a bad thing. What House Bill 2820 does is it provides additional information for local governments and for property owners to find out what it is that this proposed action is actually going to cost. What is the total picture? Right now we're not getting the whole picture. We're only getting part of the picture. I do want to make sure that I mention that this is only, House Bill 2820 is only intended to apply to land use regulations and not necessarily to all actions taken by state agencies, for instance, the Department of Transportation, that may affect property owners. I guess in conclusion, and I know that our time is short, I'd just like to say this. Why not do this? Why not have as much information as we possibly can have before making a determination of what it is that we're going to do? What's the big deal? I mean, it seems pretty commonsensical to me. Why not? Are we afraid of what we're going to find out? Are we afraid that we're going to find out that maybe land use restrictions in the state are actually costing us more than $5.8 billion? Maybe they're not. Maybe they're costing us $28. But let's find out. Why not? That's the thing I want to ask. I want to leave you with is, what is wrong with that? Thank you.
Questions?
Representative Greenlick.
Yeah, I don't think we need to debate Measure 56 right now, but and I don't want to do any Chicken Little stuff. But could we look at item 3 on here?
Sure.
Subsection 3, line 15 through 19. Metro in the Portland area, just following the 20-year residential land requirement, passed a plan that included, 20,000 acres, some large number of acres, and maybe 50,000 properties in that area. Under this, before doing that, they would have to do 50,000 individual economic impact analysis. You'd have to do an economic impact analysis for every single property. Is that right? Isn't that what 3 says?
Which vice chair do I... Vice Chair Zahner. Representative Greenlick. As I read the bill right now, I would say yes, but they would probably have to do, if that's accurate, that they did 50,000, that it affected 50,000 properties, then yes. I would
some positive, some negative. May I follow up?
Yes.
Do you have any estimate of what an economic analysis, economic impact analysis on a local property costs?
Yes, I do. Vice Chair Zahner, Representative Greenlick, in private practice, on regular occasions when I litigated takings claims, that is a common requirement when you're proving your case, when you're proving damages. I have paid anywhere between $500 to $2,500 a piece for an economic impact analysis.
So if you had 50,000 properties and it cost $1,000 a property, you've got a $50 million expenditure item under 3 in order for Metro to do what it needs to do?
I think it's $25 million, but okay.
Okay. So for Metro to do what it's required to do under the land use plan now in order to give you guys a buildable supply of land, the price would have been between $25 and $100 million just for the individual economic analysis under this act?
Vice Chair Zahner, Representative Greenlink, that may be accurate. I don't know. You might get a volume discount. I don't really know. But what I will say is this, is that what about the price, the cost that land use restrictions are imposing upon property owners now?
Well, it seems to me most of the action we're talking about here increases the value of property, not decreases it.
Perhaps it does.
But
I don't know that I...
You do recognize that's the cost, maybe 50 or 25 or some million to make a single metropolitan area land use decision to provide more buildable land and more industrial land.
Chair Gerard, Representative Greenlink, I'm not sure that I agree that would necessarily be the cost.
But you do agree you'd have to do an economic impact. I'm sorry, sir.
Please ask for a follow-up.
No, I'm done. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Schellenberg.
You weren't here and I was getting away with stuff.
It's April Fool's Day.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau, here today in support of at least the principle of House Bill 2820. Farm Bureau Policy 6.010 provides that an economic impact statement should be required as part of every environmental impact statement and that each should be given equal weight. This statement must allow for protection of custom and culture of local communities. I want to take a pretty myopic view here today, looking at Goal 3 in agriculture. Land use laws are essentially laws that protect different environments. Goal 3 seeks to protect the agricultural environment. Goal 5, for the most part, looks to protect the environmental resources. Current law, ORS 197.304, sub 1, provides for Farm Bureau's policy of equal weight. Subsection 2 addresses Farm Bureau's call for protection of custom and culture. What is missing in the current law is the economic impact analysis. The proposed amendment of paragraph B to ORS 197.340 adds the consideration of the economic impact of protecting the environmental resources when found in a Goal 3 agricultural zone and all other zones. It is entirely appropriate to determine the cost to the agricultural producers when taking steps to protect the wildlife found in the EFU zone. What is the cost in crop and livestock depredation to the individual landowner when we decide to protect the geese, the deer, the wolves, and the elk? Having said that, I'm torn between these parcel-by-parcel analysis and a general analysis or evaluation of what the impact would be. Subsection 3, as you've already discussed, is a broader concept requiring an economic impact consideration by state or local government when adopting any new rule. And I assume by reading this that it only applies to new rules, not the existing rules. But it is only prudent that we ask these questions and evaluate the answers. And House Bill 2820 requires that these questions be asked. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Schlack.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Art Slack with the Association of Oregon Counties. And I guess it's, you won't be surprised as I indicate that we have just a little bit of concern with respect to House Bill 2820. And it's primarily from two standpoints. A lot of the administrative rules that are done by state agencies and often local governments will do a generalized economic I'll call it impact or analysis of land use regulations, but they're not done on a lot-by-lot individual basis. That would require just an inordinate amount of review and analysis and an economic impact at this point. Almost to the point I would submit to you that, you know, it would basically moot future considerations of land use changes at this point because you just couldn't undertake it. The Association of Oregon Counties would supports the idea of economic analysis on a broad basis of the impacts of land use regulations, but we could not support the depth that this bill goes to, and I just would conclude that, well, also the fact that this is, in our view, an unfunded mandate if it is placed, and again, that's not a surprise, I guess, to anybody. You know, we'd be interested in looking at this, but not in this form, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any further questions?
Mr. Chair, if I might make one more comment regarding the site by site, and I kind of have to disagree with Mr. Schlack to a certain degree, because again, when you're protecting certain resources, let's say you're protecting the wolf, for instance, and that's going to have an impact on certain agricultural people, but not on others. And when you do a general analysis, what you find is, well, that's pretty minimal overall, so no big deal, but it's sure a big deal to that producer who's raising calves and the wolves decimate his herd. So, you know, there is some logic to doing it on a parcel by parcel basis, but I understand what the cost issue is as well. Just wanted to bring that out, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you.
If I can ask, I'm sorry.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I'm curious about for the proponents of the bill, at sub B starting on line 8, where you what triggers economic analysis, the economic impact is a application of a land use goal. You exclude the application of land use goal exceptions to the appraisal process.
Chair Gerard, Representative Ackerman, can you repeat your question again?
Yes, the language of the bill is triggered through the application of a land use planning goal. Do you mean by that to exclude the appraisal process if we're considering an exception to a land use planning goal? And if so, why?
Exception. Chair Gerard, Representative Ackerman, first I want to clarify, we're not talking about an appraisal, first of all. That I think is an important distinction, because we're not talking about how much the property is worth. What we're talking about is what the economic impact, which takes into
account. I accept that.
In terms of whether or not this is affected by, this includes exceptions to goals, this only applies to when a goal is, or a land use restriction is being applied pursuant to a goal. So I would say no, it would not apply to an exception. Typically, when you apply an exception, you're allowing development, your property more likely than not is being positively impacted. If you want to, if you're suggesting that we do an analysis in those instances as well, I don't know that we would necessarily be opposed to that either.
Well, my concern is that by excluding the by excluding the exception process, you're skewing the result of the economic impact, aren't you?
Chair Gerard, Representative Ackerman, I don't believe you are, no.
Okay.
If I might follow up, Chair Gerard, because in the exceptions process, what you're saying essentially is, these goals notwithstanding, development of some sort here is a good thing. We're going to let these property owners go ahead and move forward with whatever it is they're proposing. When you apply the goals in whatever form, and you say, excuse me, and you say we're not going to, either we're not going to allow your development or we're going to restrict it in some way, shape, or form, I think at that point you need to say, well, that's fine if that's how you're going to do it, but what's the impact? What is this really costing this property owner, the application of these goals or these restrictions or regulations?
One more follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Isn't it also true that by limiting the economic impact to scenic, historic, and open spaces, that you're also skewing the result to always be a more likely to be a negative economic impact rather than a positive economic impact? And why are you doing that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I have to commend you on your wonderful leading question, but isn't it true? But I would not agree with that you're necessarily skewing, because I'm sure there are instances where conservation of scenic or historic or open spaces might actually positively impact a property. For instance, a golf course would be my first example that I would use. And it doesn't just limit this particular economic impact requirement to just
those goals, but also to protection of natural resources as well.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, we'll let you guys get out real quick.
Chairman?
Yeah. Ross, it might be appropriate that you might look at an amendment in regards to an economic analysis for the planned area.
Okay.
To alleviate some of the concerns the committee has expressed. Linda Ludwig, Seth Karpinski, Randy Tucker. I'm going to have to ask you to hold your testimony to around 2 minutes apiece, if you can.
I think it's a red incident.
I think Linda's already left.
Good morning, Chair Gerard. Seth
Karpinski, if you'd like to come up.
Seth Karpinski of the City of Eugene, and I have set over on for Mr. Pefley, I've set the statement of Linda Ludwig of the League of Cities. She had to testify on another bill next door. Chair Gerard, members of the committee, as I said, I am Seth Karpinski. I'm a legislative analyst for the City of Eugene, here to testify in opposition to House Bill 2820. I've submitted a letter already outlining our concerns, and generally I would just say, along with, as you'll see an example in Ms. Ludwig's statement, she puts forth that the City of Newburgh with a potential of impact on 800 individual properties, and as the gentleman testified earlier, if we went at a conservative $1,000 per property, you would be looking at an $800,000 cost to analyze the potential impact of a land use change. Our concern from the City of Eugene is in order to adopt any land use ordinance, the impact or considering the impact on an individualized property by property basis would be so cost prohibitive and time consuming that it would be a deterrent to any further land use regulations. There's also concern that on a statewide basis that would prohibit any further regulation from the statewide on the statewide level. I let the other folks testify to that. Finally, we do believe, as set forth in my letter, that the economic impact is already part of the analysis under Goal 5, and as such, emphasizing the economic over the other social, environmental, and energy impacts that are already set forth in the administrative rules related to Goal 5, we would think is not appropriate, and as set forth, in particular in response to Representative Greenlick's questions, the cost is just, I don't think it's a matter of the sky is falling. I think it is reality that the cost would be so prohibitive as to not allow any further land use regulation. With that, I conclude my remarks and welcome any questions.
Mr. Tucker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Randy Tucker, 1000 Friends of Oregon. I will try to be brief as well. To quote Ross Day, dogs and cats living together, complete anarchy. I think this bill would cause significant problems, but I wanted to address a couple of specific things that were mentioned earlier. First of all, the Measure 56 question that Mr. Day raised, I'm not sure who he was referring to that said all those things about Measure 56. I was the spokesman for our organization during that campaign, and we didn't say the things, those things, and we didn't even put a voter's pamphlet in, argument in the voter's pamphlet against the measure. But it's worth noting that Measure 56 does provide for notice to landowners who may be affected by a land use regulation, and we're working with a whole work group of parties right now to make some improvements to that to the Measure 56 notifications. In fact, to provide more timely notification to some people and to slightly change the wording of the notices so they're more accurate and fair. But it looks as though they're going to continue to say anyway that your property value can be affected by the regulation that is being considered, and I think that tells people adequately that there's an effect they might want to take into account. It's really, as others have noted in other contexts, it's often difficult to even know on a property-by-property basis what properties are affected by land use regulation. the example that's often used is Senate Bill 12, the steep slopes bill, the landslide bill from a couple of sessions ago, where there isn't really a database that shows the slope of a property that's easily accessible and it's easy to figure out who's affected by a potential regulation. So just knowing who's affected is difficult enough, much less doing a property-by-property economic impact. I'm not aware of many other areas of the statutes where we require a property-by-property impact. For instance, when we change the tax structure, we don't do a household-by-household impact on how that's going to change your taxes, and it just seems excessive and intended not necessarily to provide useful information, but more to put a barrier in front of the rulemaking process. Finally, I'd just like to... I believe I responded in the past to the idea that about the Measure 7 cost estimates somehow representing that much money being taken out of the pockets of landowners. As with this proposed statute, when you look at a given regulation in isolation, that doesn't give you really a sense of what the overall regulatory structure is doing to protect or uphold property values, or in fact to increase them. And not just regulations, but government investments as well, to increase them well beyond where they'd otherwise be. And then when there's one regulation that has an impact in the opposite direction, that is singled out as being the sum total of reality. It's just I believe this statute provides a sort of a distorted view. And so you won't be surprised to hear that we don't support it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Rindy. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And I think the issues that I wanted to raise, most of them have been already brought forth, so I'll be very brief here. And especially Section 3 is what I was focusing on, which would apply to us in a rulemaking venue for any rule, regardless of whether it affects resources or anything else. Last week, in response to the House Bill 3557 conclusions about industrial land, LCDC amended one of their rules regarding rural industrial sites. And those amendments were intended to try to open up more industrial land for development. There will be more amendments of that nature. LCDC is interested in looking at a range of rules that we have that affect industrial land. My sense is that every one of those amendments will bring more value to the industrial properties that are involved. But I think it would have been impossible for LCDC to do that if they had to go out and assess the impact on each and every potential industrial parcel that the rule they adopted last week would have affected. That would have, whether it's $1,000 or twice that, I'm not clear on the cost, but I think it would have prevented that rulemaking, and that's the main concern I want to bring up to you.
Any questions of our panel? Representative Zoner.
Yeah, if there was no cost to this assessment, would it be okay if you went out and assessed the property anyway? If someone else paid for it, let's say I had lots of money and I said, I'll pay for all the assessments, but we want you guys to do it. Is it a cost factor in dollars?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zoner, I think if they were paid for, that would certainly remove most of our concerns, provided that we weren't looking at some inordinate lengthy delay. The problem with trying to pay for these things is it's not only that the cost for each analysis is that our department has no staff with any expertise in that kind of that's a very specialized kind of thing. So in order to get to a no-cost situation, I think you would also have to try and figure out some way for those resources to be brought in to do this analysis.
Just a quick follow-up. So I guess what I was trying to say, if it didn't cost you any money, you wouldn't be against the bill. It's a financial thing that bothers you here.
Yes, again, Mr. Chair, primarily time as well, but mostly financial.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no further questions, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Chair.
We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2820 and open a work session on House Bill 3176. Representative Greenland.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 3176.
Representative Greenlick moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 3176. those of the opinion the rules should be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 3176 will vote aye. Those opposed, no. Clerk will call the roll. This does require a two-thirds vote or five members of the committee.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye, excuse.
Representative Greenwood.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Aye.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Donner.
Aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Gerard.
Aye. Motion carries. The rules have been suspended. It is now in order to accept a motion on reconsideration. Representative Zarner.
Yes, I would make a motion that we send House Bill 3176 to which committee was it going to before?
Ways and Means.
Ways and Means for the DuPass recommendation.
Representative Zarner has moved that we move House Bill 3176 to Ways and refer to Ways and Means with a DuPass recommendation. Representative Zani moved that we reconsider.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Real estate boss.
Those of the any discussion on the reconsideration. Seeing none, those of the opinion that we consider the vote by which we are reconsidering the vote on House Bill 3176 and move it to the floor with a DuPass recommendation.
Ways and Means.
Any discussion? Ways and Means, I'm sorry. I'm not confused. No, not at this point. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Excused.
Representative Greenwood.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Aye.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Gerard.
Aye. House Bill 3176 is moved to Ways and Means with a DuPass recommendation. I thank the committee for that housekeeping. The rest of this for the audience is basically just going to open and close the public hearing on several bills just to make sure that we have a deadline of April 10th for this committee, that we have to have a public hearing on all House bills in order to hear them at any time thereafter. So it's what's commonly referred to as a tap-tap, and we're about to tap-tap for you. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 3176. And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2856, and I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2856. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2910, close the public hearing on House Bill 2910. Open the public hearing on House Bill 3061. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3061. We will open the public hearing on House Bill 3326 and close the public hearing on House Bill 3326. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2790. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2790. Continued on next page. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2738 and close the public hearing on House Bill 2738. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2899 and close the public testimony on House Bill 2899. Open the House public testimony on House Bill 2898 and close the public testimony and public hearing on House Bill 2898. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2809 and close the public hearing on House Bill 2809. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2336. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2336. We shall open a public hearing on House Bill 2984 and close the public hearing on House Bill 2984. We shall open a public hearing on House Bill 3342 and close the public hearing on House Bill 3342. Open the public testimony, public hearing on House Bill 3462. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3462. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3247. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3247, open the public hearing on House Bill 3241, and close the public hearing on House Bill 3241, and close the meeting, adjourn the meeting of the House Committee on Environment and Land Use.
You should let your freshman vice chair do that.
Oh, yeah.
That would be good. That's a good learning experience.
It'll be.